All right, let's take our Bibles and turn to Luke chapter 22. We will be getting there to the very last verses of that chapter as we proceed. Just wanted to mention a couple other things of current interest, to me at least. Today's March 17th. That is St. Patrick's Day. And it's interesting how the Catholics will steal anything that they can to promote the advancement of their, what do we call it, religion. But I would just, Saint Patrick, if we don't believe in saints, but Patrick of Ireland had quite a testimony. It was very encouraging if you were to actually study what happened with his life. And my sister was telling, I had read it a long time ago. Becky was telling me a little bit that she had read it more recently. Very interesting. He was captured. He was a slave for a druid and somehow escaped and then went back to preach the gospel to those druids. And in the meantime, in the about 1,700 years since then, a lot quicker than 1,700 years, the Catholics have come along. And as Catholics most normally do, they take the religion of the people that are present and adapt their practices to that religion. You go to Mexico, and all of a sudden, Catholicism looks like Mexican paganism. You go to Ireland, and Catholicism looks like Irish paganism. And that's how Catholics have, Catholics generally have done whatever it takes to get more people under their control. They've not much concerned themselves with the truth. They just want to control more people's lives. And so that's kind of a problem. In older, am I saying I'm old if I'm talking about something I experienced and say it was in older days? When I was younger, Baptists had a strong, or the Baptists that we were familiar with and fellowshiped with, had strong associative ties to the Christians in Northern Ireland who were being persecuted and terrorized by the Catholics of Ireland. And I'm not condemning anybody here, but for that reason, you would never wear green on St. Patrick's Day, because that showed that you were in, that you favored the Catholics. Okay, now, I'm not saying that. I see lots of green out there. Most of you are like, green, Irish people are happy and all of that, so no problem. But the Protestants would wear orange in defiance of the Catholics on St. Patrick's Day. And so I just wanted to kind of, it actually was life and death, and it may still be for some people in those areas. It's surprising to us that in America, where we seem to have freedom and protection and all that, that there would be these types of problems in this modern world, and yet there is. And it wasn't that long ago, because I'm not that old, that there's a lot of people here saying, no, Sonny, you're not old at all. So I can't be that old. Anyway, but that just goes hand in hand with something. As I mentioned, the idea that the Catholics would use whatever means they needed to accomplish their purpose, which is to promote the control that they have over people throughout the world, is not new for Catholicism, and it had its peak, or it sees it. We recognize its greatest power and influence in something that a man by the name of Ignatius Loyola started, which was called the Society of Jesus. The Society of Jesus was very militant, called the Pope's Militia, and very militant group of men who were charged, and when they took their oath, promised to use whatever deceitful means necessary to act like Protestants, to act like those despicable Masons or Baptists or anything else, just to be able to promote the means and the goals of the church and the Pope. And so those that are in the Society of Jesus were called Jesuits. And it's interesting that we this week have a new Pope, and he's the first from the Society of Jesus. So while he seems to be, I mean, even myself, I look at some things about him and think, oh, he seems to be a little more conservative. You have no idea. I have no idea what he is, because he's vowed to be as deceitful as possible to be able to promote the goals of the church and the Pope. Now, it's interesting that he is now the Pope, so I don't know if that's like the head of the Society of Jesus and the head of the Catholic Church are in one person now. But anyway, just a little comment on current things going on in the world around us. Catholics will be Catholics, and they the people in the Catholic Church are not wicked. I mean, they're sinners, and they're on their way to hell if they trust what the Catholic Church says, but they're not evil, evil people. But a Jesuit has vowed to deceive on purpose to promote the ideals of the church and the Pope. And so I don't say these things about Catholics so that you know the guy that you work with at churches or at church at work is a Catholic and you just attack them and tell them all these wicked things about their church. We want to give them the gospel, but don't be lulled into a feeling of things are going to be better now because this Pope is going to clean up the things that are going on in the Catholic Church and he's going to stand for traditional conservative values. He may, but the whole purpose of everything that a Pope does is to advance the Pope's rule over the people of the earth. And that is anti-Christ. I won't go as far as Ian Paisley and say that he is the Antichrist, but what he does is Antichrist, that's for sure. All right, Luke chapter 22, we'll begin looking at verse 63. We'll be looking at verses 63 through 71, the last of this chapter, and then we will have just two chapters left to finish this gospel. Luke chapter 22, verse 63. And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him, and when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, "Prophesy, who is it that smote thee?" And many other things blasphemously spoke they against him. And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, "Art thou the Christ? Tell us." And he said unto them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God." Then said they all, "Art thou then the Son of God?" And he said unto them, "Ye say that I am." And they said, "What need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth." I want to end up focusing on the idea of when man has his way with God. When man has his way with God. But I want to, before we get to that at the end, set this passage in its chronological context, in the order of how things happen. Because none of the Gospels tell us everything that happened from one point to the other. They give us a different perspective, and we have to look at all of them to see the whole story. We're not going to be able to take the time to go into each of those. If we were teaching a class on the life of Christ, we would. But we're teaching the Gospel of Luke, and so we're going to key in on the things that he tells us. But to understand what he's telling us, we need to understand the chronological context. So, and some of you, some of you may not be familiar with the things I'm talking about. I apologize, but we have a lot to cover, and so I'm just going to mention things. If you talk to a friend, look into the other Gospels, read the other Gospels, you'll be able to see the stories that I mentioned, the accounts that I mentioned here. To put it in context, let's just start with the time when Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. He had gone there after the last Passover and the institution of the Lord's Supper, and he was there, prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, and was betrayed by Judas Iscariot in the Garden of Gethsemane and arrested there. When he was arrested, they led him and took him, and they took him to the high priest's house. Now, I mentioned this last week. I believe it's in John that we hear he stood before Annas, A-N-N-A-S, Annas. And Annas was not the high priest. He had been a high priest about 20 years before that, but he had five sons and a daughter, at least one daughter at least, and his one son-in-law, Caiaphas, was the high priest at the current time. So in the 20 years since, he had placed his sons and his son-in-law in office. Now, how did that happen? Because in the Old Testament, we see that a high priest is installed and he stays there until he dies, and then his son takes his place. Well, we have to remember that the Jewish people, the Israelites, did not control anything in their lives. They lived under the control of Rome. Rome allowed them to do certain things, and if Rome decided that it was time for a new high priest, then there would be a new high priest. And so Annas was shrewd enough and powerful enough to say, okay, I'm out of being high priest, but this son or that son, he worked along, so of course he still had very, very lot of power, but he didn't, and it's interesting, Rome, to show its authority, didn't let the high priest even wear his garments, except for three times a year. Okay, when we think of how the Old Testament describes the high priest, he had very elaborate garments. The priest just had a linen coat or something like that, but the high priest had colors and stones and things all over. They only wore those in Jesus' day. They only wore those three times a year, three great feasts, and those garments were held in the fortress under Roman control, and the priests were allowed to wear them three times a year. That just kind of the Romans letting them know who's in charge. So they bring them to Annas, and this is in the middle of the night, and I don't have the time to go over all the things about what happened to Jesus that is against their own system of jurisprudence. Some people studying the Jewish court system have said that it was even more just and provided more ways to obtain mercy than even our system. Now, our system today, I think, is twisted. But even if you were to use or employ the system that we have here in America, it's very careful not to accidentally charge someone. Now, we have twisted that in a lot of ways, but that's today. But anyway, the Jewish system of jurisprudence, very, very fair, very things like you couldn't begin proceeding against somebody late in the afternoon because you didn't want to rush to judgment. You couldn't, if you were going to execute somebody, they couldn't be executed that day. You had to have a full day go between the sentence of judgment and the execution, so that if anything were to come to mind or up, there would be time to be able to change your mind about that. When the judges voted for or against execution, if you voted against execution, you could not change your mind. If you voted for execution in those 24 hours, you could change your mind. So there are a lot of things, and much more than that, that this system that they employed for judging cases was very merciful, gave many opportunities for mercy. None of that was followed in Christ's arrest or sentencing or anything like that. You had to have some type of charge to bring against somebody. And when they brought Jesus to Annas, they didn't have any charge. That's why they brought him to Annas. He's the shrewd man. They finally got him. They bring him to Annas, and what does Annas do? Annas starts asking him questions, trying these fishing. Annas goes on a fishing trip. Says, tell me about your disciples, and tell me about what you... And Jesus answers shortly, but basically says, I spoke all the time in the temple. You bring somebody that said... You find somebody that says I said something that was wrong. So they bring him to Annas, and Annas gets nowhere, basically, has nothing. Now, because it was family, it was a very large place, but basically, from standing before Annas, they probably took him across the courtyard that most likely Peter was hanging out in, where there was the fire and all that, across the courtyard to Caiaphas's part of the complex, Caiaphas's mansion. And he stands before Caiaphas, and in the meantime, Caiaphas had gotten some of the other priests there with him, and here they have another in the middle of the night trial, you might say. And here, they gather all kinds of false witnesses. The Bible tells us one after another. They all come, but none of them could get their testimony to agree. And there's a long sequence of seven different types of questions that you would ask about somebody's testimony to make sure that both testifiers, both witnesses, were telling the same story. But anyway, they have these false witnesses. None of them can agree. Finally, two come and say, this man said something. Now, they twisted what he said. And even for that, you can't be charged or all he said is that if you tear down the temple, now that would be a bad thing to attack the temple of their religion. But he just said it. He said, tear down this temple and in 3 days I'll rebuild it. He didn't even say that. If we look in John, he said something different. But either way, those false witnesses, Jesus' response to all the false witnesses is silence. He doesn't respond to that. He doesn't give any credence to their lies. And it's almost as if what they're screaming and yelling and accusing him of just echoes and rings and convicts, the echo of it convicts them of the lie that they're saying. He does not answer a word. Finally, Caiaphas, knowing that he's got nothing, asks him directly. Okay? Ask him if he is he the Christ? And Jesus says, yes, I am. When he's asked about a truthful question, he answers it in the affirmative. And here is another, Jewish people did not, you couldn't self-incriminate yourself. You couldn't incriminate yourself. Even if you did say something that would incriminate you, that couldn't be used against you. But that didn't matter to them. He heard it, said, we don't need any further witness. So then, at that time, he tears his garment, which is, of course, not the special garment, because the Romans had that. But the other rulers and chief priests that are there begin to spit in his face, to beat him, and slap him. And that takes place. It seems like they get tired of that. It's probably very right in the middle of the night. He was probably arrested around midnight or 1 o'clock. And what we read as far as this trial that we're reading about here, which we haven't talked about, probably is about 5 o'clock. So between 12:30 and 5 o'clock, we have him before Annas, and then before Caiaphas, and all the things happening with Peter going on during that time. And then the spitting and the beating and the slapping by the leadership. And then it seems like they want to take a nap or something, it doesn't say. But they tire, they weary of doing that, and they hand them over to the thugs. Remember I said you had the temple guard with their sticks and all came along? Well, they were back there. And this is what we read about here. So we have two sets of beatings by they kind of just go right into each other, but two sets of beatings. You have the slapping and the spitting and the beating by the chief priest and the leadership, and then the younger ones, or the lower ones, the ones not in as much power, they follow suit, of course. They're just going to follow what the leadership have done, and they're going to try to expand upon it, I would say. And so that's what we read about in verse 63. And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him, and when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, "Prophesy, who is it that smote thee?" And many other things blasphemously spoke they against him. So he's in their control there. And then when it began to be daytime, verse 66, as soon as it was day, the elders, the people, and the chief priests and scribes came together. So there are three trials by Jewish people. There's the trial, quote, the trial before Annas. And then there's the standing trial before Caiaphas. And then there's this trial that we're reading about here, that we just began reading about, that's before the Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin. This is you couldn't try somebody in the middle of the night. It had to be during daytime. So they had to wait until day to have a formal, real sentence against Christ. Now we know, because of what has been going on, this was not any type of a real sentence. It was a mock trial. It was a fake trial. But in order to please the people, they would have had to say, "We tried him. We tried him in the court of law, in the proper manner, and all of that." So this trial comes then. This is a daytime trial in the temple. Okay, so they had gotten from Annas and Caiaphas' house across to the temple, because that's where the Sanhedrin sat, in one of the great rooms where there's many stones, and they sat in a certain way. And so that was done there. Now, just to go forward a little bit to continue our chronology, once they finish, they're going to bring Jesus before Pilate. Pilate will question him some, and they're going to say some things. Pilate is going to find out that he's from Galilee and then send him over to stand before Herod. Herod's men, Jesus doesn't answer Herod, and because Herod looked forward and wanted to see some miracle or something, but they just mock and beat him, and then they send him back to Pilate, where Pilate finally gives in to the will of people and sentences him to crucifixion. But that's what's going to happen through these trials. So basically, we have three Jewish trials and three Gentile trials, sort of. Annas, Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin, and then Pilate, Herod, and Pilate again. In this mock trial, as I'm calling it, as soon as it was day, the elders and the people and the chief priests and scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, "Art thou the Christ? Tell us." And what does he say to them? He says, "If I tell you, you will not believe." We could go back throughout his ministry and see how many times he had told them, and they never believed. And then he says, "And if I also ask you, you will not answer me." Now, this happened just a couple days before. Remember? Now, it's been more than a couple days for us, because we take longer, because we're trying to understand everything that took place here. But remember, he asked them about John the Baptist. He says, "The baptism of John, was that from heaven or no?" And they said, "We can't tell you." Basically, they said, "We won't tell you," because if they had said yes, okay, John foretold, foreran for the Messiah. If John was from heaven, then Christ was from heaven. If they said no, all the people would rise up in rebellion against them. So they didn't answer. So Jesus most likely is referring back. He says, "If I ask you, you're not going to tell me, neither," he says, "will, nor let me go." You're not going to let me go. This is, and so we're seeing here, and again in verse 53, he says, "When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness." We're seeing using the power that they have at this time. And so he says, "If I tell, you won't believe. If I ask, you will not answer." But this is what you want to hear. He had already said this. Basically, this is a restatement of the end of the conversation that Caiaphas, if we want to call it a conversation, the interrogation that Caiaphas had with him. So in my mind, he just restates it. He He's got to say it because he's got, in a certain sense, he has to incite their anger so much that they want him crucified because he needs to be crucified. And he knows that. He's definitely in control of the situation, even though he's standing there bound. So he says, you won't answer me nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. This was direct reference to Daniel. And in Daniel, Daniel writes about the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God with the Ancient of Days in Daniel chapter 9. They all recognize that. That's what he was talking about. Because he said, hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then said they all, are you saying, art thou then the Son of God? They knew when he said that, he was saying, I'm Son of God. And they asked, they wanted confirmation. Art thou then the Son of God? And he said unto them, ye say that I am. Now he wasn't saying, you say that I am, but I'm not. He's saying, you rightly say that I am. And the way that they would, and the way that this should be understood is, you absolutely right. I am. In another, in Mark, in one of, either before Caiaphas or here, it does say that he said, I am. Yes, he gives the affirmative. And there was no confusion here. I mean, if you don't understand that ye say that I am means yes, look at the way they responded. They knew it meant yes because what did they say? Then, and they said, what need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth. They knew he was claiming to be God, and of course that was blasphemy. Now, of course, truthfully, it was blasphemy for them not to believe that he was God and to claim that he wasn't God. But to them, his claim of being God, the Son of God, was blasphemy. And now, in the last 2 minutes, I'm going to tell you what I thought was going to be the point of the lesson. Before that mock lesson, we have God, we have man being able to have the way that he wants with God. When I was thinking of this, I was reminded of a sermon I saw listed on, I think Pastor Strange preached it a couple, God in the Hands of Angry Sinners or something like that. But this is, when man has his way with God, look at that in verse 63, when man has his way with God, and the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him, and when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, prophesy, who is it that smote thee? And many other things blasphemously spoke they against him. Now we don't have time to go into this a lot, but let's just think quickly through this. It says, when the men who held Jesus, think of that, holding Jesus. Jesus is omnipotence, all power, and yet omnipotence is held captive. When they held, those that held Jesus mocked him. They mocked him. Jesus is God. He has all the glory of heaven. He stepped out of that to earth, and yet it's glory that is mocked. And then it says, they smote him. They smote him. We smite things that are evil, and yet he's the epitome of goodness, and man smites goodness, smitten. Goodness is smitten. And it says, and when they had blindfolded him, isn't that what, they blindfolded him. They presumed to take God's sight away from him. Omniscience that knows everything seemed to be blinded. And then they struck him. This is God stricken by man. And then they said, prophesy. Who is it? They felt like because he couldn't see that justice would not be served, that they could defy God, that they could defy justice. They could hit him and get away with it. And so here, all of this takes place. All of these things, Jesus is God. He's standing there blindfolded. How do every single one of us get the breath that we breathe. The whole world, everyone's breath, the animals, the everything, we find out later in Colossians, is sustained by the power of Christ. Okay? If Jesus had just forgot to think about those men's breath, the moment that they were claiming, "Prophesy, tell us who smote thee," they'd have fallen over dead. And yet man can, we could be in that same place. Mankind can get to the place where we do this to God. And God suffers all of that so that we can have a place in heaven. Many other things blasphemously spoke they against. That was just the tip. That was just the start. They had to go further and further. They had to do better than the leadership did, than the chief priest. And we're there with them in that. It's in our nature to have joined with them and done all of that to the God of heaven, thinking that we can hold God captive, that we could mock the glory and greatness that he has, that what he does should be punished, that we would know more than him, that we could do things without his knowledge, and that we can get away with it. That's justice defied. So that's what happens when man has his way with God, and each of us could be in that place, except that Jesus suffered all of that, and when we turn and trust in him, he gives us a new life that changes us. Let's pray. Our Father, we